Nietzsche, figured what can we begin that we need? We begin with Zarathustra. And so I have collaborated in thought with these people now for 10 years. We've published a book recently, it's free, Open Humanities Press, called Plankton Dreams by Tito Mukhopadhyay, who is one of the people that I'll be thinking with. And so if you have any doubts on the complexity of thought of autistics who are classically autistic, i.e. who read as extremely autistic in their gestures, who can't speak because of motor issues, autism has nothing to do with a cognitive deficiency, read Tito's book. So I begin with a quote by Lucy Blackman. Lucy Blackman is particular in the field of autism because she was much earlier using facilitated communication, which I'll talk about in a second, much earlier than most of the American-based autistics. Lucy Blackman is in Australia, and facilitated communication came from Australia, a researcher in Australia who was working with cerebral palsy. Facilitated communication has to do with the realization that one of the aspects of autism and other motor diseases is that there's an activation problem. And so the question is, how do you activate? If you think about how, for example, the posture of language in the context of a computer, you'll note that the body is relatively deactivated. You may work at your computer and notice that it's when you walk around that the thoughts come more freely. There's a reason for that, because the activation while walking is easier. So the question has become, how do we activate? And so facilitated communication has been asking that question for now 30, almost 40 years. And the activation can take very different forms. And this is really what I'll be talking about. What's interesting about Lucy Blackman, though, is that she's now writing her second book. Her early book was about coming to language through facilitation. Her second book is a critique of what happened when she was brought to measure by neurotypical standards. So Lucy Blackman has an MA in literature from the University of Monash in Melbourne. And she writes, "Remember that my body and its orbit include my thoughts, my real emotions, and what I call my feelings. These are not the same as what you people, neurotypicals, call feelings, but are my carrying vibrations, flashes, visual blocks, touch horrors, smell tickles, and the crossover that comes from them." In autistic Lucy Blackman's writing, carrying attaches itself to nouns. Lucy again. "When I refer to something within myself, I often use the word carrying as an adjective just before the word for the emotion or whatever. So when I draft what I want to say, the word carrying frequently appears, but I usually edit it out so it doesn't confuse or distract neurotypicals. What do I mean by carrying my world? I think that most people see themselves as moving between the things and the space on each side of them, so that the area in front comes up and parts before their faces, because that is how the television camera shows reality. Somehow I use space differently. My space envelops me as if I were in a cocoon, and the items and other aspects of my environment enter and leave that cocoon." So this project looks at this word, carrying, and tries to think philosophically about what the work is being done by this carrying. And also, of course, by what is being done by editing it out. And one of the things that is worth noting in this regard is that one of the main aspects of, there are two things I would say that have generalized in the autistic populations that I've come into contact with. One of them is that every autistic I've ever met, and again, I'm always talking about the classical end of the spectrum. What I say has lots of resonances across the spectrum, but I'm much more familiar with the classical end of the spectrum, is that autistics talk about not knowing. Three things. Autistics talk about not knowing where their bodies begin and end. So if you see autistics flapping, they say what they're doing is that they're sensing where their bodies begin and end. So that's one thing. So the question of the body world differentiation is always at stake. Note that Lucy talks about the orbiting. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that autistics, and I've written about this a lot in the past, don't take the human as the center of experience. And it's very confusing and strange for them that we seem to be so certain that the human is at the center of experience. So if you've ever been in contact with an autistic and you notice that that there's an attention drawn elsewhere, this is not an unobservance of the human. It's an activation of what else is here as well, right? So that's something important to remember. And I don't remember what the third one was. It'll come back. So while thinking about carrying, I think it's important to recognize that carrying is connected to movement. All of my work, for those of you who don't know my work, has been about exploring philosophies of movement. And so improvisation has been at the center of my practice. Usually I'm talking about dance, not today, but hopefully you'll see where improvisation is feeding into it. Now, to move as an autistic is to live in paradox. On the one hand, there is nothing but movement, most of it involuntary, or so we think, right? Involuntary. This will be questioned a bit later, which for neurotypically inflected existence translates as strange, unpredictable, disturbing. The autistic body simply moves too much. And if you're not sure about this, you can read account after account of neuroscientists saying they won't stand still in my fMRI experiment. On the other hand, it is this same overabundance of movement moving that keeps the autistic singularly open to perception in its most complex iterations, making directly felt the world's edgings into itself. Now, this is the third part I was going to say before. For those of you who know my work, this is something I've discussed at length elsewhere. But one of the things that autistics talk about, which has really influenced my way of thinking also as an artist and as a dancer, is that their experience of entering into an environment is not one, in their vocabulary, of chunking. So they say what neurotypicals do is they chunk. And what they mean by that is that there's a categorical imperative that is almost immediate in their engagement with any kind of spatial encounter. We know that in the so-called neurotypical experience, because hopefully by the end of this I'll have convinced you that there is no such thing as a neurotypical, but in the neurotypical experience, this chunking is not so cut and dry. There is a half second or a micro juncture where the objects have not yet formed for perception. You may have experienced that in periods of trauma, in periods of love, in ecstasy, erotic, drugs, alcohol, tiredness. So, but what's interesting about autistics is that this period is much bigger. And so if you're in contact with an autistic and you wonder why they're coming into a room and sit on the floor, it's because the furniture hasn't chunked. And it's a much slower perceptual process for that chunking to exist. Now, Naoki Higashida, an autistic from Tokyo, chunk means coming into itself. Yeah, sorry. when you see an object, he writes, sometimes I pity you for not being able to see the beauty of the world the same way we do. Really, our vision of the world can be incredible, just incredible. When you see an object, it seems that you see it as an entire thing first, and only afterward do its details follow on. But for people with autism, the details jump straight out at us, first of all, and then gradually, detail by detail, does the whole image sort of float up into focus. This capacity to directly perceive experience informing what I've elsewhere called autistic perception, which again is on the continuum with neurotypicals. I'm not saying this belongs to autistics. It's a limit concept of perception, I would suggest. Involves a continuous carrying, a moving with of experience in the making. This project or this paper asks, what if we took this carrying, which Blackman feels she has to background for neurotypical consumption, and made it the motor of experience? What if we said that carrying is precisely what motivates an experience to become what it can do? What would this approach alter in terms of accounts of agency? How would such an approach give credence to this most lively of modes of perception that is autistic perception? And So the larger project wants to take this question of agency in what I call the volition intentionality agency triad, which is, I would argue, at the heart of neurotypical modes of thinking, and force it to tremble a bit by exploring how these three terms come together and what we mean by volition, intentionality, and agency as they come together. And the concept that I'm choosing, it's as an easy audience for this to replace agency with his agencement, which unfortunately is untranslatable. That's why in the translations it's been translated as assemblage by my partner, but this is only because it's really, really difficult to translate. And agencement has to do with the way that an event, a field shifts in relation to the kinds of forces that affect it. And so it isn't primarily led by a subject that would impose their will on it. And so it brings out the question of where will is in the event, right? What Blackman calls carrying the feeling is all about the movement of subjectivity very much in flux. And here I'll give you just one little paragraph of philosophy. Feeling here, as in Whitehead, is not to be understood as an external response to an existing event. So Whitehead calls his philosophy a philosophy of pure feeling, as opposed to Kant's a philosophy of pure reason. You're going to have to read Whitehead if you want to know more about that. But feeling is what defines for Whitehead the quality of the event in the event. There is no external subjectivity. The subject is not the activator of the act, but what emerges in the act. So Whitehead's philosophy does in no way suggest that there's no subject. Just like Simondon, it's a question of where, under what conditions, how, and how do the conditions shift what we might call a subject. How an event coalesces into itself is what he calls its subjective form. The subjective form an event takes has a specificity and a rigor and a historicity, but it is far less static than what we normally understand a subject to be. This subjective form, the subject of the event, does not necessarily resemble a human subject. And I won't go more into this, but this is at the crux of where I think carrying can lead us. Now I'm going to skip lots of pages of philosophy and come back to the idea of the neurotypical as a block of human existence. So what I want to suggest is that the neurotypical is so pervasive as a category that it is, as I said before, rarely defined as such. And most of us have overlooked the ways neurotypicality structure our original myths, starting from the idea that humans are distinctively above all other forms of life, all the way to the idea that certain forms of human life are more worthwhile than others. This has had an effect on how we value not only different forms of organic and inorganic existence, but also forms of human existence. Think of the general belief that Down syndrome is not a worthwhile life. In Europe, 98% of the fetuses are now aborted. Or think of the ways in which disabled people are infantilized and often mistreated in institutions. Think of the high unemployment of people with disabilities. Or think of the destructive ways in which the cure-focused Autism Speaks, which is the main organization in the US, devalues autistic experience. Or think of the ways women have been segregated out of certain professions because of norms around intelligence that exclude them. Or think of the legacy of indigenous politics and the ways in which indigenous people are ignored, abused, discarded, and infantilized. Neurotypicality takes for granted what the human should be by extension limits the breadth of what a human subjectivity might look like. Here, a kind of mutual natural selection is still at work that believes that the fittest, who are, of course, the people we've given that title to, are the ones to whose image we must conform. The neurotypical mantra, I can, based on a very narrow definition of volition, deactivates experience, I want to suggest, rather than opening it to its potential. For if I can't, what's the use? With carrying as the silent refrain that moves experience in the making, this mantra begins to fall apart. Who is the I in the ecological field of experience in the making? How does the I figure in the crossover Blackman writes about in the first quote I read you, the crossover that tickles and triggers, that feels the movement in its coloring of experience? How does I figure in an account such as Higashida's where, quote, the voice I can't control is different? Or in autistic Donna Williams' complex account of how humans are less bodies than edgings, she writes, I knew people by their edges. Where does I figure in Ralph Savarese's important account of autitype, which is facilitated communication, as relational activity? Autitype defined as the persistently poetic coming to language of autistics who use facilitated communication. So what is very, very interesting about facilitated communication is that when autistics begin to write with the assistance of facilitation, they write prose, I mean poetry and not prose, in all cultures that we've explored. So they write rhythm. They, of course, can learn to write prose, but first they write rhythm. Where does I figure in Lucy Blackman's assertion that, quote, the most interesting reality in my life is the relationship between facilitation and autism? So I skipped the philosophy not because we couldn't have a great discussion about philosophy, but because I wanted to get immediately to the question of facilitation. Because the stakes here, and you know, for me at least, and that was why I so inelegantly had an outburst yesterday, they're urgent. The context of facilitation being discredited as a practice has come from the scientific world. And so facilitated communication came into existence in the US, particularly in the late 80s, early 90s. This coincided with a period of false memory syndrome, so-called. So this was a period where weird things were happening with people who were disabled or children or less powerful, perhaps, having so-called false memories or giving false accounts, being forced to give false accounts in a therapeutic context. And the question emerged, and there were cases where this happened with facilitated communication. So under what conditions was it possible to know that an autistic was actually writing their own writing, and under what conditions were they not doing that? When were they doing that, et cetera? So there was an incredible backlash in the 90s against facilitated communication. And we're not out of the woods yet. I can discuss later a case in New York happening right now where this is still the case. I want to suggest that, well, of course, any technique can be misused, and I'm not questioning that. There's something that many autistics have noted around this question of rhythm that I mentioned before. I mean, surely, across the world, not every facilitator is a poet. This would be, a stretch. So, there's no question, and I'll read you some work in a minute, there's no question that the language of autistics, or autitype, as Ralph Savarese calls it, is particular. So I'll just leave you with that for a moment, but also suggest that the neurotypicality orientation, which takes agency, volition, intentionality as its center, can obviously has trouble with a model based on relation. Particularly, it's been difficult for people to understand one aspect of facilitated communication, which is that after autistics, so all of the autistics who contacted me 10 years ago used facilitated communication in a very active way. So their facilitators were always present when we were communicating. And the facilitation can be very different depending on the person. It can be done with the voice, which is where the voice can move the autistic into an activation. It can be done through most of the time it's done through a touch on the shoulder, but it can also include holding a pencil to stabilize the wrist. So the facilitator is at different degrees from the autistic. All of these autistics, with the exception of one, are now not working with a hands-on facilitation, but none of them can work when their facilitator, or they often have more than one facilitator, is not in the room. So this has become a real issue with scientific experiments. because they can't get they want the facilitator out of the room, basically, in order to test whether the person is really doing the work of their language, their thinking. And autistics say, well, it's just really, really weird, isn't it, that we've been accused of being unrelational and unempathetic. And when we tell you that communication is relational, you question the very basis of communication for us. And so in the, you know, what Lucy Blackman's doing in her work is trying to challenge the presupposition that facilitation isn't as active in a neurotypical environment, so-called, as in an autistic environment. She writes, speech grows in one for a number of reasons. What might it mean in the context of a world that doesn't parse easily for language to grow in one? So what I didn't mention, you probably know this from this morning's presentation, is that with the sensory issues that accompany autism, there is an overload, a constant overload, and a real difficulty for parsing. So parsing is the ability to subtract from the environment. Neurotypicals parse very easily, hence the chunking. So it's very easy for, I'm assuming, for many of you in the room, or maybe most of you, to put your attention here and not at the slight buzzing of the light. So that's an example of parsing, right? So what does it mean? What might it mean in the context of a world that doesn't parse easily for language to grow in one? What would facilitate such a growing of language? What carries language? Can the carrying, the growing of language, of speech, have different rhythms, different sonorities? Can language be in line with autistic perception? And if so, how is this facilitated? Facilitation is usually understood, as I mentioned, as anathema to independence. In autism research and education, the term facilitated communication has been used to discredit autistics' capacity to think and write. A person who needs facilitation is understood to be incapable to varying degrees of directing their own experience. With an account that begins with pure experience, now I've skipped all of the philosophical part, but that's a concept from William James, where predetermined subjectivity is not at the forefront, where the event-orienting agencement is what moves experience, facilitation begins to mean something quite different. Is facilitation not everywhere present in experience, all along the spectrum of neurodiversity? What communication could ever happen without agencement? If we consider facilitation as the conduit, the agencement of a field of forces, what movement does not require it? What movement is not directed by it? So I return to movement here. Perhaps the best place to begin is with movement. And obviously I return to movement because that's the thing I know the most about, right? So neurotypically inflected movement is usually taken as voluntary. And I'm going to give you a long example, but follow with me. And hopefully it'll make sense. Now, I have to say that it's taken me a long time to get here. In my last book, if you read it, you'll notice that I use the concept of the involuntary. And now in this book, I'm not accepting the involuntary anymore. I'm really working with the non-voluntary as on a spectrum with the voluntary. So for years, I accepted this idea that autistics had involuntary movement. So it's taken me a long time to recognize that there may be a problem with this category. And I think that, you know, anybody who's a dancer or a musician in the room or who's thought about this knows that there's a great aspect of movement that is non-voluntary. And that, in fact, you know, if I teach a drawing class, for example, that's where we're headed. We're headed to autistic perception and non-voluntary movement because we know that the drawing needs to beckon from there. We know that in a movement exploration as well. So the question within an artist community has always been, I think, how do we create the conditions for that? So I think we have a lot to learn from how autistics perceive. So I'm going to begin with an apple, and I'll give you a short version of my apple. So what I'm saying is that there's... imagine this. So we're in a kitchen. The neurotypical takes the sequence I'm saying here, I'm shortening this, between picking up an apple on the counter and eating it as ordinary, believing that the motion was unfacilitated, and placing the eye at the center of the gesture. So I want to eat this, I eat it, I did it. My gesture. The autistic, on the other hand, because of sequencing issues and difficulties with activation, may not be able to volitionally grab and eat the apple. So this is one of the key issues with autism, that the executive function makes, or the disturbance in executive function, in part and other things, of course, make it difficult for this activity to be directed or to work in that directed way. But this is interesting. The apple may nonetheless get taken and eaten. So autistics have probably, most of them, eaten apples. But it might just as well end up staying on the counter, because for some strange reason, the body moved away from the table. Voluntary, non-voluntary would be an easy dichotomy to use to separate out these two experiences. One was voluntary, one was involuntary, in the sense that the body was, in a lot of autistics say, my body didn't do what I wanted it to do, which is not really surprising given that most of the writing we get from autistics are from 12, 13, 14-year-olds whose Cartesianism has slipped in just like it does everywhere else. But if instead of beginning with agency, we turn to agencement, asking not what the subject did, but what the event proposed, another version of the task comes to light. So I'm going to give you two apple-eating versions. Let's say that in both cases we are in the same kitchen. The tending toward apple for the neurotypical is likely facilitated first by a sense of hunger. In this situation, hunger may seem solely located in the body, but it is actually an effect of the field. Think, for instance, of how often hunger strikes at the idea of food. Sorry, I know you're hungry. Without first a conscious sense of being hungry. In these cases, the food acts as an agencement to hunger, activating the experience of a body feeling hungry. This is equally the case when the food isn't actually there. When this happens, the subjective aim, which is a Whiteheadian concept, is tuned to a virtual object. In either case, actually or virtually, pulled by the sense of hunger, you find yourself reaching. The apple becomes the facilitator for a gesture that does not strictly belong to you. This gesture is in an ecology of hunger, apple, body, movement. The apple activates in its co-occurrence with the feeling of hunger and the reaching response. What is emerging is an event of hunger appeasement. In the reaching, something else happens as well. Perceptually, a parsing has occurred that singles out the apple from the counter and everything around it. This parsing with the perception, or as Whitehead would say, the non-sensuous perception that accompanies it, also brings along a felt impression that the apple has a specific size, depth, weight. This is the historicity. You see it as an object, and in doing so, you unsee the environment with which it co-composes. This allows the reaching to be precise, except if you're wearing one of those masks that Myra and Romain made. You grab it, and the apple finds itself in your hand exactly as you had previously seen, felt it, or so it seems. This grabbing, which included a seeing touch previous to the actual touching, was made possible by the hapticity in the visual perception, which provided, in advance of the actual touching, a sense of what the apple might feel like, a feeling that likely also is starting to include a preconscious tasting. Your mouth is already watering. This doubling of touch vision mixed with the tripling of touch taste vision, which includes a singular parsing for hunger apple reaching, allows you to grab the apple and bring it to your mouth. You take a bite of it, completely unaware of the complex movement just executed. In the case of the autistic, things may not go so smoothly. First, hunger and impulse control may be overlaid, leading toward actions that are more confusing than those outlined above. Blackman speaks of her echolalic tendency of saying McDonald's whenever she sees the large M of the restaurant's golden arches. This tends to lead people to assume that she wants to eat there, when in fact she doesn't like the food. So even so, autistics who don't speak, that I've talked about as non-speaking, that doesn't mean that words don't come out of their mouth. It means that they don't produce the kind of meaning that they need to produce for all kinds of reasons I can talk about later. She writes, "In crowded restaurants, I reverted to asking for food that I associated with that kind of interaction. But this was less a request for what I really wanted to eat as a memory process. I had to make do with what I had pre-programmed, the echolalia, much as the way I would ask for a hamburger if I saw McDonald's. I learned this was involuntary the day we were standing on a pedestrian crossing inside of the big gold M. We were talking about where we would have lunch, and I typed, "Please don't let me take you. Please don't let me make you go to McDonald's." As I got to the word to the M word, my voice cut in, and I declaimed, "McDonald's." While physically tugging at my bewildered companion so forcibly that we ended up through the sliding doors and in the line of surf-crazy youngsters, Australia, before she was aware of it, and certainly before she could begin to analyze her own responses. Here, the lack of impulse control becomes its own kind of foothold on experience, fostering as it does an agencement not directly allied to the feeling of the event at hand, but to a spectral feeling activated in the repetition of a memory. A kind of short circuit of non-sensuous perception takes over, the past fielding the present against what the current moment desires. Two event paths collide. The more than, the excess of autistic perception is here revealed in all of its contradictions as the surplus that should have been excluded. So this is what parsing does, right? It excludes a surplus. But this is the effect of autistic perception, that exclusion is difficult. Lack of inhibition has its advantages and its disadvantages. Say McDonald's were nowhere close by, and the impulse controlled itself enough to direct the field of attention toward the apple on the counter in the kitchen. Another challenge might still be in store. The apple might just not resolve itself clearly for perception, backgrounding itself in experience. The vase beside it, reflecting the sunlight, might stand out more. In this case, the hunger agencement might be redirected toward the light reflection agencement, thus leading the autistic's movement toward the vase, despite what they initially perceived as their actual interest in the apple. This might confuse the onlooker, who might then assume that the autistic wasn't hungry, or worse, that she couldn't distinguish between vase and apple. And this happens all the time in experiments, right? If this is the case, other techniques will need to be invented to facilitate the right balance between depth perception, color, tactility, hunger, and movement. This facilitation is likely going to involve another person, at least in the beginning, with whom the environment in its unfolding will be navigated in ways that will morph over time based on the needs of the relation. Placing carrying in front of words is a way of inscribing for thought and language this necessity of relation, foregrounding how each act necessitates its own variety of carrying across the field of experience. For Blackman, touch does a lot of this carrying. And so I won't go on a lot about this, but Blackman then goes on to describe a lot of the techniques that over the years, now 30 years almost of facilitation, have been invented, how they've had to be switched over time as new experience became possible. And certainly I know for myself and for other artists I know in the room that a lot of our work is about reworking the conditions for experimentation, what Joao called the enabling constraints in his poster earlier on. So where I'm going with this is that it wouldn't be hard in a discussion to figure out all of the ways that facilitation works in ways in a non-extreme case of autism, how a teacher, for example, creates the conditions for a certain facilitation of perception, what kinds of techniques were used, for example, in the movement workshop I attended today to get us to use our voice. This was very interesting to me because using a voice is actually quite challenging for many people because it makes them feel self-conscious. And it was very interesting to me how many techniques were used to get ourselves out of the self so that the voice wouldn't immediately be linked to us, my voice, but could become a kind of collective play on what a voice can become. So I have a lot more to say about that, but I won't stay too long because I want to finish on an extraordinary paper that William James wrote in 1896, which I'm sure would be really useful for people in the sciences to read. I think of it as a really early paper on neuroscience. And so in this paper, what James is asking is where the feeling of effort is situated. The paper is called The Feeling of Effort, 1896. And he's asking this, you know, he's asking this in the way that his earlier work did. It's sort of a formal paper. I mean, he begins by saying, is the effort in the muscle? And, you know, he goes on all kinds of stages to see where the effort is located. And he begins with a concept of the motor idea, which I believe he is the same concept in his later work that he calls terminus. So I'll just give you a bit of a definition of terminus, since he doesn't really define motor idea in that early work, taking it from the literature, I'm assuming, of that time. In Essays in Radical Empiricism, James develops this concept of terminus, and it's easy to read James without ever noticing this concept because it weaves through everything, but it isn't foregrounded. And he talks about terminus as the pull that activates an event, not as the goal of an event. So the terminus may be an apple, say, but the terminus, terminus apple hunger might get you off the couch, but it won't necessarily get you to the apple. In a neurotypical experience, if you go, then you're walking from the couch, I'm in my living room, and you're walking to the fridge, but then your cat comes up, and you pick up your cat, you're probably not going to tell the story that you don't know how to get an apple, right? You're probably just going to assume you were actually going for the cat, and 15 minutes later, it might be time for the apple to come back, at which point you might open the fridge and think, what am I doing here? So these kinds of experiences, they happen to us all the time. So where is the effort, and how is it experienced, seemed to me to be a really, really worthwhile exploration because it connects to the question of volition, right? So how do we feel volition in a physical sense? And what he's uncomfortable with, and I don't have enough time to go into all the detail around it, is with the sensory motor schema. And so this is really interesting. This, you know, this is over 100 years ago. Thinking, well, the sensory motor schema doesn't do justice to the feeling of effort because there's a disturbance that that we haven't accounted for in that sensory motor schema. And so he says, you know, it doesn't include, also, it can't contend with the forms of incipient activity that are part of the activity. So my work, for example, on looking at how a relational movement or an improvised movement works through a concept that I talk about as pre-acceleration is key to that. So just to get a little parenthesis, in my own research as a dancer, I've... it's been clear to me, or it was clear to me for many years when I danced, that to think of one body affecting another body in a kind of subjective sense would be an impossible account of improvisation because bodies simply move too fast. So that would require a kind of conscious account of how movement moves. And it just doesn't work. So something is happening between bodies in an improvisation that is faster than an account of something as simple as I'm watching out for what you're doing and I'm responding to what you're doing. And Bill Forsyth writes about this really beautifully in his own practice as choreographer of the Forsyth Company. What I found was that there was this, in every movement that was executed in a context of dance, there was this this kind of welling that oriented the conditions of where movement could go. This is what I call pre-acceleration. And when you're improvising, you're actually improvising across the pre-accelerations rather than across some kind of more normative idea of a form or a movement. And in a more expanded notion of this, Bill Forsyth talks about it in terms of cueing and aligning. And he's got a very, very complex piece with about 30 tables, which is actually a piece that is quite dangerous to dance because it involves climbing over the tables and falling over the tables. And it has all kinds of improvisatory strategies embedded in it. And the dancers, if you look, you can find this an account of this on the site Synchronous Objects, are cueing to the potential of the movement, not to what has already happened. So this is where my other work goes. So what James finds, and I'm getting you to the point of a long analysis, is that the feeling of effort comes when the movement is actively inhibited. So the feeling of effort is coming in when there's an activation of inhibition. Now, if you think about the context of autistic perception, the one thing that isn't there in the same way as in a more neurotypically inflected existence is inhibition. Part of what allows an autistic to have the complexity of perception that they talk about is a lack of parsing. And part of what makes the more neurotypically inflected find it difficult to attend to the ineffable relational field is a very developed inhibition. And I think that, you know, the consequences of thinking about where inhibition plays into this account are interesting in where we might go with the question of who is at the heart of, or how we are at the heart of our own movement experiences and other experiences. Now, what I'm not saying, just in case this was misunderstood, is that we don't belong in our experiences. I'm not saying that at all. Now, I'm not saying either that there's no volition. What I'm saying is that to frame experience on the basis of a subject pre-existing with a model of volition misses a big part of what's happening. And missing that big part has deep consequences for how we might understand the complexity of what experience can do. And so, let me just see if I'm missing. Oh yeah, so I finished the paper with a proposition that we think perhaps much more concretely and imaginatively about what we might call the facilitation of facilitation. So the ways in which not only are there human models or techniques of facilitation, but in the ways in which the environment is, of course, also a modality of facilitation, and how those modalities of facilitation that we come to take for granted when we put ourselves always at the center of experience impoverish or potentially impoverish an account of what the world might be. And I'll just leave it there.
Okay, so thank you for the questions. We have like 15 minutes before having to go.
Should I go ahead? Wow. Wow. For me, this was entirely new. And I lack so much background. So I guess if it's not sidetracking, I'm going to ask some very basic questions. My impression was that there was a strong polemic aspect here, arguing or suggesting new points of view vis-a-vis points of view that I'm not familiar with. So, one basic question is, are the people who approached you 10 years ago and read Nietzsche and other philosophy, do they communicate with you directly via speaking? No. There's facilitation. So it's someone else who speaks for them or signals or...
Oh, no, sorry, it's computer activated. They're using programs on the iPad or on the computer that are voice activating the text that they write.
Okay, so they write, you listen to what they write, which is...
Yeah, we Skype mostly. So we're on Skype with me on one side of the Skype. They're sitting there.
Another individual or everybody together?
We have five different locations often, and sometimes one or two individuals or a group of individuals at a given location. Some of them are actively being facilitated, or sometimes the facilitators are just in the room.
And they do that, I mean, you found that or developed that method of communication because these individuals cannot speak or cannot speak in a way that you can understand?
I didn't develop it.
Or you used something
that exists. I don't use anything. So these were people, sorry, I should have made this more clear. So facilitated communication came onto the landscape in the 80s. As a modality of as a recognition that some activation would allow autistic to speak or write. Up until then, the main form of the consensus in the literature, and it's still unfortunately a large consensus in the literature, was that autistics were cognitively disabled and were incapable of a theory of mind. So they were incapable of connecting to the mind of another. We can talk about that more. But so facilitated communication appeared on the landscape around that period. Now these people who contacted me, and they don't necessarily know each other now, they know each other, but this was sort of independent, would have had access to facilitated communication by then. Some of them for quite a long time, in which case they weren't physically facilitated, and some of them less recently.
Another question, it may help others, so I'm taking I'm asking for a privilege of another question. The feeling I had is that you were arguing or suggesting alternatives to something that scientists who study autism, could you say what kind of, relatively speaking, are they all being studied? Or can you be autistic without being studied?
Oh, God.
Or do you consider it a privilege to be studied?
No.
What is the situation?
That's what happens when you bulldoze through 40 single space pages in 1 hour. No, the question of study hasn't been on the forefront of my work at all. But since I'm in that context today, I brought it up. In the last 5 or 6 years, I've been often asked to review neuroscience papers. I think similar to the one that you gave this morning. So people who are studying in a scientific way the question of usually motor functioning in autistics. So I'm familiar with the scientific literature in large part because of that. I'm also familiar with the fact that there are all kinds of studies that I've debunked, so-called facilitated communication, and I'm of course familiar with studies that have not. What I'm saying really on that scientific front is that the conditions for study have to be changed if you take facilitation relations seriously. Because the conditions of autistic perception require another way of entering into the problematic of causality, if we wanted to speak to the poster that we had up there. But my main concern is less that in my own work than to think in a much larger scale of the contemporary ways that we understand knowledge in society and what effects that has on political questions, ecological questions, more what I call more than human questions.
That was very convincing, even though I
thanks.
Hi. I think you're absolutely right about the location of cognition and languaging not being within an individual subject in a cognitive frame. I totally buy that. And I think that the most compelling science that I've seen in this regard, that's also been tremendously illuminating with in terms of studying any kind of language production, has been Charles Goodwin's relationship with his father, Chill. And there are these beautiful papers where Chill has a stroke and can only say yes, no, and. And using just these three words, he's able to be an incredibly fluent communicator, tell jokes. And there are just these absolutely beautiful moments where Chuck and his family and Chill do this wonderful languaging together. And I think that your practice as a dancer and as a philosopher and many others could be very, really central to understanding a distribution of the task of producing language together. I have to say something about FC though, because every study, every double-blind study that has presented information to people who use FC regularly and then tested with reasonable controls shows that the information presented to the person with autism is not then able to be reproduced by the facilitator alone. And it's a very simple study. And
not every. Often, I have four that aren't. But
well,
yes.
That's a very simple study. You present information to somebody, and then you ask their facilitator to produce that information or some part of it, and then been unable to do it. So the question of authorship is crucial. The reason that I think it's really important to make that point, whereas I agree with the thrust of what you're saying as an approach to language, I think is because there have been so many abuse scandals where facilitators or people who've been facilitated have abused their relationships.
Absolutely.
And also, I think there used to be a program in the UK, it's been cancelled recently, I think because of the increasing civil rights that disabled people have, called Does He Take Sugar? And it was a great radio program, and it had such a great title because this was the experience of disabled people being asked whether they want something and being facilitated out of existence. I think it's tremendously problematic to provide a voice for people who don't have a voice in a way that leaves some ambiguity as to whose voice is being heard.
Yeah, I really, really deeply appreciate what you're saying, and I think that, as I was mentioning earlier on to Michael, I'm close to, there's a case in New York right now around this issue. What I would say is that I'm not a scientist, and I think that's important in my answer. That I've worked now 10 years very closely with people who had not been able to make themselves heard before facilitated communication, who through the bridge of facilitated communication are doing extraordinary work. You know, there's just example after example of that. Unfacilitated, right? I mean, not touched. But because of these issues, we've spent a lot of time at the Sense Lab, the lab I direct, it's especially 4 or 5 years ago, but we have another event in the spring, looking for other ways to create a kind of facilitated communication. And the most successful, and the one that I would like to work with the most, again, was taking the keyboard and putting it on the ground. And in inviting autistics to step on the key that would activate that had a sensory they were like sponges, so you could feel the key like the E or the A or the B, and you would hear a sound. And autistics, without any kind of a hands-on facilitation, who were working with language, were capable of creating language through that. So part of the problem, I think, in our techniques has to do with the incredible exhaustion that comes around the field of autism in terms of the parents trying to constantly come up with the care that they need, the funding that they need, and et cetera, and not enough people who have been willing or have had the time to come up with alternative techniques. And that's definitely something we're thinking about all the time. So yes and no is really what I'd say to that.
Okay. I think my question is quick. I saw the Amanda.
Amanda Bags, yeah.
Yeah, it's really very, very interesting. And just one thing you said, and I can relate to that video in particular, is the constant movement, which could be small movements, almost ineffable, which help autistic person to get tuned to the environment. I found it really interesting. And then when you say that the question of involuntary is like a category deconstructed in a way by your own experience, how can they witness, are they aware of what's voluntary and non-voluntary in that constant flow of movement? How can you know that, or how they witness about it?
Yeah, they're totally aware of it, and you can read the writing. There's a lot of writing by the people that, I never read you. Let me read you very, very quickly a few accounts of Audie type so that you can hear the rhythm that I was talking about. Just a second. Yeah, so this is an example of why, of an aspect of facilitated communication. So Audie type is communication facilitated, of how particular it is. So this is Emma Zerker-Long. She's about 13. Decision to sing while thinking about birds with peekaboo tail feathers brings happy feelings. So notice how the verbs are used. Larry Bissonnette, 55 or so, institutionalized till he was 50 years old, and then came to facilitated communication, since no longer needs facilitation, 50 years of his life in an institution. Powerfully pushed by climate change, Hurricane Sandy has lapped up on the shores of Mitt Romney's campaign and plopped large loads of wet sand on, looking more shallow now. Ideas about privatizing lots of lending helping hand to less privileged people's assistance. And it's this particular, another one by Larry Bissonnette. The plight of more apples freezing in the orchards of Vermont is what I more immediately worry about. But I do peer out beyond our borders and see our connection to the powerful forces of political change. I see the changing of old guards to new patterns of compassionately spread laws to protect our environment and freedoms to be looked on equally regardless of our differences. And then the last one, DJ Savary's, yes, dearest dad, sad dad, dad, you heard fresh self and freshly responded, deserting your fears and just freed dad, sad dad, dear, saved me. Yes, 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 yes. So they're fully aware of the complexity of how their movement works. They don't have a vocabulary to talk about it. We don't have a vocabulary to talk about it. And so a lot of the work that needs to be done, I think, has to be done on the side of neurotypicals to do the work of testing our own expectations, our own beliefs around where volition does the work in our movement.
Well, in a way, that's what I wanted to say. The application, application of what you're saying, is that we have a lot to learn about them or about other people, and not only autistic people, about our patients or clients. I think that's a whole paradigm shift we have to make.
I agree. Myra.
Okay.
So we can have two last questions.
Yeah.
The two last.
Okay.
Because we have to travel around Paris afterwards.
I'm going to be unfair here, but because I get to work with Erin for, like, we work together, so. But still, I have a question or a comment. And it's in relation to what you said. And I just wonder how much of what we non-neurotypicals talk is really understood by the other. I find myself in situations where all the time I'm saying something, and when I receive a response back, or it's completely like, did I say that? Like, how did I say that? Or how not did I say what I wanted to say? And what I wanted to say, actually, do I know what I wanted to say? And how compositional it is in the moment that you're saying it. So for me, it's just a question of how we are underestimating what's underneath meaning, what's underneath, not underneath like lower, in a lower layer, but what else is composing with meaning. And what else is there if there's not really only meaning? Like, could there be other things? And also, just for Erin, I don't know, there's something for me very close in terms of autistic perception and artistic perception. And also, like with your example, I develop a theater piece that it's a very short piece, but basically, it's telling a story without the content and only yes and then for and no then and then but and well. So it just cuts out like the words between the connectors and stays with the connectors. And it's just these artistic expressions that are really needed to make something, to give an expression to something that it's there. But if we don't devise these techniques to express them, then they're not heard. Yeah.
So, can I just make a very quick point? So very quick point.
I think I was much too polite in my question. And I did want to make it clear that I think facilitated communication is dangerous.
I got it.
And that it's also every disability civil rights organization and many of the, you know, the APA and most of the kind of respected scientific bodies don't agree with it because it's dangerous. And you need to
make
that point clear.
Yeah, I disagree with you profoundly, but read my books. You know, it's not everybody. It's not everybody. The neurodiversity movement is very much inclusive as relates to facilitated communication. But I don't want to have that conversation right now. We can have it later. I think we have another question.
Well, the last question, comment?
Yeah, thank you. It seems to me, maybe, that autistic way of perceiving, like, I don't know in English, but in French, it's bâton rompu, like, mm-hmm. Could be not so far from dreaming of the neurotypicals.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Beautiful.
Personally, I worked 7 years with the same group of autistic, and I'm dance and choreographer, and made a piece with them. Mm-hmm. But I also, so I worked with them on dreaming and what is dreaming for them, etc. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have another experience with the larger group. So do you know how they dream?
Yeah, no, but I want to respond to that. This is so important. Just with a little image. So one of the reasons I've worked with Bill Forsyth is because the autistic community at large, especially the US, but also in Canada, many people and now many groups of people have asked me whether we could dance. So create a modality of a kind of contemporary choreography that would be interested in so-called non-volitional movement. And with a real desire to challenge the idea that it is only neurotypicals who can have access via neurotypical movement to non-volitional movement, which is definitely something we've all experienced in classes. You know, how to go from a neurotypical movement to starting to, right? So the image I wanted to maybe leave you with, and I can definitely talk about this more, is I was invited by autistics who have a conference called AutCom. So this is a conference by autistics for autistics, and the neurodiversity movement has a plea, nothing without us, nothing about us without us. And so this was a real honor to be invited to this event. I was the only person there who was not either a caretaker. I don't consider myself neurotypical, but I can pass. So I was giving them a talk about Forsyth's movement of improvisation. We were exploring it together. In an autistic conference, doesn't look like this. The lights are off. The chairs are gone. There's usually two or three chairs, and people are moving. And they're sounding a little bit like earlier. It sounds a little bit like whale song. And what I noticed in that, and this is not directly what you're asking, but what I noticed is that I had never felt more listened to. And it totally surprised me because all of the conventions of attention were disrupted. And the forward attention and all of that. And so it made me think that there is so much work to be done at those interstices that aren't about language. My work has also worked, because I'm a dancer, at those areas. In the last year, I've taken more time to come to language, partly because of the work on affect in the community around the humanities and the philosophy has tended to think of language as not being as emergent as other forms of movement. And I've wanted to bring language back into that conversation. But so yes, definitely there's that. And one of the things to emphasize here is that autistics tell me all the time that we do not have, it's a little bit like what you were saying about the stroke, that we have a tendency to exclude forms of experience that eclipsed or are eclipsed from language, like dementia. And that there's a lot happening in the relation to someone with dementia if you don't have to go by language. So absolutely, there's work to be done there. I've just not done it.
So thanks, Irene. Thanks, Guillaume.